Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comment. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Greetings and salutations, everyone. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday. We have another great show in store for you today. Let's take a look at what's on tap. First up, we're talking about Ebony Magazine goes head-to-head with the GOP. Now, that's going to be an interesting conversation that took place between two people. I think you're going to get a lot out of. Kobe and Shaq in the news again, and this time is not about basketball. And I also want to talk about the National Labor Relations Board rule that Northwestern football players could unionize. Now, what does this mean for college sports? We discuss this and much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Before I get started, though, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge Google. And I want to start by expressing my gratitude to them because they recognized Dorothy Height in a Google Doodle. Now, what is a Google Doodle, you ask? Well, when you go to the landing page of Google, they typically have the word Google spread across the web page, and then they have the little search text box. But invariably, what they'll have is a picture or an image or some way to pay homage to an individual or a cause or a holiday or the likes. And this week, they did it to Dorothy Height. Now, of course, this being Women History Month, there's a lot of what's going around, celebrating, extraordinary women throughout the month. And Google did that in a Google Doodle. So if you go out to the Google landing page, you would see, at the time, you would see Dorothy Irene Height, a picture or image, on the landing page. Now, quite naturally, millions of people go to Google daily and hourly, in fact. And so I thought it was a great gesture by the organization to actually pay homage to Dorothy Height. Now, who is Dorothy Height, you may also ask? Now, She's pretty much known for her role with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so for the most part, height set on the stage behind Martin Luther King Jr. as he gave his famous what people call I Have a Dream speech, and we know it on this show to be something different. But she co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus with Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan. She has received the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Gold Medal, the two highest honors awarded to an American civilian. She also stood on as Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2009, and Obama called her the godmother of the civil rights movement after her death in 2010. Now, Height made major contribution to both the civil rights movement and the women's liberation movement of the 1960s and 70s, but most often marginalized in each movement because of her race and gender. What I liked about what Google did is that they mentioned her not in a racial overtone, but in a more of a woman overtone, as a professional overtone, and they gave her credit for her contributions to the civil rights movement, and they footnoted that she was an African American. So that just goes to show the advancements that we're making in our society when we don't have to always categorize a person first by their color and then second by their contributions. And so when Google did this, I thought it was a great step in the right direction when you first talk about the person and the enormous contributions that they make. And then, oh, yeah, she was an African-American female or a black female. And to me, I thought that was an awesome a way for Google to do that. Now, as I mentioned, Height made contributions in both the civil rights movement and the women's liberation movement of the 1960s and 70s, but was often marginalized in each movement because of her race and gender. She helped organize Dr. King's March on Washington, yet was not asked to speak along with the male civil rights leaders. She was accepted to Barnard College in 1929, but was not able to enroll because she was black. She went to New York University instead, where she earned a bachelor's degree in education and a master's in psychology. After graduation, she began to work with the YWCA, where she fought to expose the exploitation of black women working as domestic day laborers in what were commonly known as the slave markets. The women would gather on street corners in Brooklyn and in the Bronx and would be hired for 15 cents an hour by white suburban housewives who were cruising for cheap labor. Height's crusade brought public attention to the slave markets and drove them underground, although they later reemerged. She also oversaw the desegregation of the YWCA and founded the Y Center for Racial Justice. She organized many programs to strengthen racial ties, including Wednesdays in Mississippi, a program that flew interracial groups of Northern women to meet with black and white women in Mississippi, and black family reunions, which were large celebratory gatherings dedicated to celebrating the culture and traditions of the black community. Again, my hats off to Google and especially Dorothy Height for the major contributions that she's made to our society at large, and in particular the African-American community. So up next, I want to talk about what's going on with Ebony Magazine and the GOP. Now, there are some controversy going on here, but before we do that, I'd like joining me in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJema. That's AskJema. Now, quite naturally, we're going to be, she mentioned to you a couple of weeks ago about a big announcement. And at the end of the show, we're gonna emphasize what that big announcement is, and we're going to be bringing that to you shortly. But I introduce to some and present to others no other than the great Jema Hill Cook. Jema, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I want to talk a little bit first about Ebony and the dispute between Ebony and the GOP. And I want to play a soundbite from the Root magazine to set the stage for our listeners so they can understand what happened here. Now, this is a commentary from Fox News, which you always have to take with a grain of salt. They primarily audience is the low information voters, as they're called. But I want to play for you what the conversation was about the GOP and Ebony and what happened on Twitter. And so if you haven't heard, take a listen to what was said here.
All right, follow this. A senior editor of one of America's most influential African-American publications, Ebony Magazine, exposing her true colors this morning. Her name is Jamala Lemieux, and she spent all day yesterday on Twitter insulting black conservatives. She started the debate on her own, complaining about a new online magazine founded by Dr. Ben Carson. When Rafi Williams, a black conservative and son of Fox News contributor Juan Williams, tried to enter that debate, this was her response. Quote, oh, great, here comes a white dude telling me how to do this black thing. Pass. Williams, who is also the deputy press secretary of the RNC, is not white. He is black. And the senior editor followed up by saying this. I forgot that tweeting something about a conservative is like leaving a cookie out in a house full of roaches and turning the lights off. Wow. That wasn't the apology I thought this was heading. That's where this is heading. Rafi Williams joins us right now. Rafi, were you surprised about the anger that came your direction?
I was very surprised by it. You know, it caught me off guard. I thought I was just making a point about diversity of thought and promoting that in the black community, and I got attacked for it. So that caught me very much off guard.
So it got caught off guard, and you asked for an apology, and you said, I was looking at your avatar. She did apologize this way. I was looking at your avatar without blowing it up, so your picture without blowing it up. I apologize for that. However, I care about nothing you have to say. That's the worst apology I've ever saw.
Well, I don't really think that's a real apology, because what's at issue here is I'm trying to promote diversity of thought, diversity of opinions. I think it's what made America great. And what she's doing instead is saying, oh, if you were white, I still would have dismissed your claims. I don't think my race has anything to do with the points I was making. I think they stand on their own. And I think that's something that that's why conservatives were rallying around me yesterday, is because they saw this as a slight against conservatism. It's a slight against my ideology. And I think that America's built for debate. It's the First Amendment, I think.
I mean, you get it. You hear a lot of that from Senator Scott. You hear about that Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, and now you're getting some backlash. Now, today there is some news, and the RNC is not taking the sitting down. They're actually backing you up. And Reince Priebus is requesting that Ebony Magazine apologize to you, saying this quote, Rafi deserves an apology from Ms. Lemieux and from Ebony, not just making assumptions about his race. But
okay, so if you didn't get all of that, basically there's a magazine that was being kind of floated around by Dr. Ben Carson. And if you heard some of Dr. Ben Carson's rhetoric over the last couple of years since the president has been in office around health care and just some of the vitriol that he spews, you know, every time he hits Fox News. And if you heard the fact that Ms. Williams, Jamila Lemieux, what she made a comment was that, oh, great, here comes a white dude telling me how to do this black thing because Williams, which is Juan's Williams' son, responded to something she said earlier. So basically, magazine was being published, and Ms. Lemieux made a comment about it. Williams responded, but because on the surface, he didn't look African-American because, I mean, even when I saw him on news, he didn't. So she commented back about a white guy commenting about a black thing, but it turns out to be black. So Fox News got all up in arms because of the comment she made about him. And so they're asking for her to apologize, you know, about something. So my question to you, Jim, about, you know, a little bit of the backstory, you want to give a little bit more, of course, is why is this such a big deal about the comments she made, and why can't the GOP just suck it up and drive on?
Because we don't control the narrative. And when you don't control the narrative, you get to make big deals out of things you want to make big deals out of. So here you are, and we could go on, you know, to the end of time, talking about the types of things that people that are directly associated with the GOP, not some right-wing magazine, but I'm talking people that are intimately associated with the party itself, who have said some of the most vile things about people of color, about this president, about the first lady, and not once has there been an uproar, an outcry to come out and apologize consistently. It happens, but it doesn't happen enough, and it definitely doesn't happen to the magnitude that we're writing letters to people. I mean, Rush Limbaugh says something every day, and we know he's directly tied to the GOP. You have Glenn Beck that has made all sorts of comments. You have Bill O'Reilly, who just last week or the week before made such an asinine statement about members of the Congressional Black Caucus and calling Barbara Lee, I believe, out of California, a race hustler, and all these other sorts of names he stated. And no one has asked him to apologize for a daggum thing. So even if I disagreed with everything Ms. Lemieux had to say, the fact that we are having to have this conversation in 2014 anyway, the fact that you have people, I don't have an issue with black conservatives in terms of, you know, what it is they believe in. I have an issue when everything you do is a name calling, is a denigration, is condescension. That's what I have a problem with. So you can believe what you want to believe, but why is it not a name call? Why is now all of a sudden we live in, since we have a president that doesn't look like any other president that we've ever had before, now we want to talk about Hitler, and we want to talk about dictatorship, we want to talk about all these words that we've never used before of any other president. We want to send out, as Dr. James Peterson said earlier, that these dog whistles. You have Representative Paul Ryan, who a couple of weeks ago made this statement about generations of men of color in the urban community that's never worked before and don't have any work ethic. Has he apologized for that? Even when he was told to apologize, he didn't apologize for it. So how dare the GOP, the RNC, President Rance Priebus, send a letter to Ebony Magazine to a journalist who is so far removed from the Democratic Party about anything she had to say on Twitter, and you got elected representatives, elected officials who make these sorts of statements every single day, and they're not called to the carpet. You had Newt Gingrich running for president making these sorts of statements. So, you know, you want to get me up in arms? You can get me up in arms because it's time out for the facade and the fakeness. That's all I'm concerned about. If you want to call it, let's just call it across the board. And if we can't call it, but all of a sudden we want to be offended by something. If I'm offended by it, I should be offended if you gave somebody a like or I didn't like. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And that's just kind of how I feel about it. And at no point do the GOP, the RNC, conservative, Tea Party, whatever wing of it you want to call it, do they stand up and apologize for anything they say without underhandedly saying something else just as crazy. So, you know, it's unfortunate that Ebony feels like they need to bow down and issue this letter and issue this apology to the RNC and to Rafi Williams, who looking, I didn't know he was black when he was on TV talking. So I definitely wouldn't have known it looking at his avatar. But, you know, he shouldn't have gotten her conversation. She wasn't exactly talking to him. So, you know, he inserted himself in her dialogue, and there you have it. So, you know, what she said, you know, was 100%, you know, right. No, I'm not going to say that. I haven't seen everything she said. But I know when I heard earlier last week that Ben Carson and Armstrong Williams was putting together a magazine for black conservatives, I was like, oh, my goodness, what is that going to be about? So I had that thought because I've heard the crazy stuff that Ben Carson has been saying lately, the Hitler comments and all these sorts of things that he's been making statements about it, and how he's talked not just in disagreement with the Affordable Care Act, but the tone and tenor and the nastiness of it. See, I don't mind you having a different thought of opinion when it comes to certain policies, but to be so downright nasty and as I stated, condescending and just even about the president and things he said about him. So to hear that he's trying to come up with a magazine for black conservatives, along with Armstrong Williams, who every now and then I agree with Armstrong. So it's not that I don't hear the thoughts of a conservative, but they black or white. It's not that I don't hear them. So every now and then I agree with Armstrong. You know, sometimes he is on the right side. So to hear that those two were coming together to put out an online black conservative magazine, I was like, woo, I wonder how that's going to be. So I can understand what her original thought was, being a journalist. I'm not even a journalist.
You're right, right. So I wonder then, the lines of politics and entertainment seem to be blurred nowadays. You don't know what's what. So I guess my question is, are we too far gone that our politicians are not capable of separating the two in order to resolve our real-world problems? I mean, the problems of energy, the problems of healthcare, the problems of, you know, joblessness, you know, all of these things that are real problems that are affecting real people, and they seem to keep getting caught up into these sidebar conversations because they want to entertain people as opposed to being politics. So, again, the lines of politics and entertainment, to me, seem to be blurred. Are we too far gone that our politicians are not capable of resolving the real world issues?
Well, here's the deal with that. You know, we were lulled, we as a nation, were lulled into a deep sleep. And we were lulled into a deep sense of complacency. And for some reason, we thought that the relations between the races was okay. Things were okay. We would have minor flare-ups or isolated events, or so we told ourselves they were isolated events, or that person may have deserved it, whatever the it was that happened to them. So we have been lulled into a false sense of, and I say this very, 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 very loosely, of a post-racialness, of that we were all okay and that we really had saw the dream that everyone quotes in terms of black and white being together and sitting at the table of brotherhood. We really thought that we had met that goal that Dr. King so famously talked about. And so then ushers in a man whose name was hard to pronounce in the very beginning, whose mere presence in the room caused so many to be uncomfortable. The mere mention of his name caused many, on both liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, to be uncomfortable because we thought we were ready for what he represented. And so here we sit now. It's like you go to, like you say, you're really hungry. And so you say, I'm going to go to a buffet. And you get to the buffet, and you have everything you've been tasting all week. They have the chicken and dressing, and they have potato salad, and they have your sweet tea, and then they have your desserts and the peach cobbler. And they have everything you wanted. And while you're there, you see something amongst all of that good stuff, and it is not supposed to be there. It could be something crawling. It could be something flying. It could be something laying on top of whatever it is you was about to get. And all of a sudden, everything you wanted, you no longer want anymore because it's not what you thought it was. And so here we sit right now in America, second term of this man who we thought we were so ready to receive. And at the moment, even before he was elected, I don't know why we thought things were going to get better when during the campaign we heard the nastiness that was coming from the Republican side, eventually that came from McCain and Sarah Palin. We heard it, and they were being applauded. They weren't being shut down. You saw the old, elderly white people at the town hall meeting make the claim that he wasn't from here and he was Muslim. You saw the fact that for 3 years of his presidency, he had to prove he was a citizen, something that had never been done before. So, no, it won't be politics and dealing with the real issues because we've never dealt with the real issue of race. And having him and his family there forces those people who cannot stand you simply because of the color of your skin. And there are people that are like that. We can play like those people don't exist if we want to, but there are people that do not like you too dark or your skin is too white. It's on both sides. It's on both sides. I'm not just saying it's all white people. There are some black people that cannot stand white people just because they're white, period. It has nothing to do with nothing else. That's that, and you can't tell me nothing different. So it's on both sides. So we've never dealt with that, and we've talked about that since we've been on as a show about race and the real conversation that needs to be had about it. And so until it's sad, but if this was any other president that had done some of the major things that he's accomplished, you look at Clinton and how positively he's spoken of based on how he left the economy and some of his signature pieces of legislation, even though the one he wanted the most, health care, he couldn't get done. But he's still regarded as a great president. You look at George W. Bush and all the chaos he caused, the lies he told, the untruths, the half-stories that he told, and yet somebody somewhere will find something to praise him about, right? But you look at this president, and he's done the one thing that no other president was able to do. Like it or not, he has provided health care for millions of Americans that need it. And you have 23 states that decided, we don't want to be involved in that, so we're not going to do the Medicare expansion part of that. And that they're leaving so many people behind simply because it's of him. If they cared about their people being healthy, then they would have accepted the money 10 times over because it's not costing them anything. You know, when you talk about a party that's supposed to be so fiscally responsible, here is something that you as a governor, as a state, are not paying for 3 years, 100% covered by the federal government for 3 years. And then in year four, you'd only pay 3% or 5%, some low number. So forth. So if it's not that it's about him, because you're not going to spend any money, because you're saving money. Because now people who were uninsured are now insured and not driving up the cost to everybody else because they got to go to the emergency room to get an inhaler because they don't have a primary care doctor that they can go and see to get their prescription refilled. So I mean, so politics. Will it change how we – will we – no, we won't, because we will not deal with the issue of race totality and what it means. And that's a hard subject because it means so much and is different to everybody. But until we deal with the fact of the matter and until we call it what it is, we will find ourselves here again. So, you know, as thankful as I am, and grateful that in my lifetime I have been privy to the accomplishments of a great man and a great woman of color, I'm also saddened because so much more could have been done, and we wasted so much time on pettiness and wasted so much money, once again, for a party that's supposed to be fiscally responsible. The amount of votes that they've taken to repeal the Affordable Care Act costs us money. It costs us, the taxpayers, money every time they go for a vote, but yet they're the ones that's fiscally responsible. So, no, we won't ever, in my opinion, during his presidency, accomplish and really get to the nuts and bolts of what we need to get to because of their blatant dislike, distrust. And on some levels, for some of them, not all, but even for some of the elected officials, just downright hatred for this man because of who he is and what he represents.
You know, you mentioned Representative Barbara Lee moments ago and the exchange between Mrs. Lee and Bill O'Reilly. I want to kind of park there for a second and talk about Representative Barbara Lee's, a Democrat from California, how she slammed Bill O'Reilly for using what she termed racist code words. And what was interesting is that her response to Bill O'Reilly was saying that for saying the word race hustlers, such as Lee didn't want to have a conversation and that that they get voted into office by portraying their constituents as victims. Now, on Thursday evening last week, Bill O'Reilly interviewed Representative Paul Ryan. He's a Republican from Wisconsin. About Mrs. Lee taking a line in a speech Ryan made about poverty. And it was the, and I quote, tailspin of culture in our inner cities, and calling it a thinly veiled race attack. Now, when it seemed that Ryan was being too passive in his answers, O'Reilly asserted, they don't want a conversation. They want to solve the problem. These race hustlers make a big living, and they get voted into office by portraying their constituents as victims. Now, she was were trying to prove O'Reilly's point. Representative Lee office issued this response. Unfortunately, we've come to expect language like welfare queens, food stamp president, and now race hustlers from the right wing and Mr. O'Reilly. It is disgusting and divisive and should never be accepted in our national discourse. For us to achieve the American dream for all, we must engage in this conversation that has been sparked about race and poverty. Even if it is difficult for some, racial discrimination, poverty, and income inequality remains issues that must be debated and addressed, and these kinds of code words only get in the way of solving the real problem. So, Jim, my question, are we too far gone? That politicians are not capable of resolving the real issues. And your response about race and how we need to deal with that seems to be echoed by Representative Barbara Lee in her comments to Bill O'Reilly. So it seems like you're spot on in here. So what is it that you and Representative Barbara Lee see that we as Americans need to really grab a hold of so we can really move this conversation forward and then get to solving the real business of America?
Well, it's just like any conversation that you're having with somebody that you have a disagreement with. I'm not hearing you if everything you say to me is negative and derogatory and condescending and you're calling me names. I'm not going to hear you. So if all we're going to do is continue to call one another names, race hustlers and welfare queens and lazy and even poor now is something that you know you should be ashamed of. If everything you're saying to me that doesn't provide me with any ray of hope, I'm really not going to have a conversation with you. It's just like in a marriage. If everything you say to me is negative, we're never going to get off the reason of why we're having problems in our marriage because I can't hear you. And so we can't hear each other because some of the louder voices in the room have the bigger microphones, and they're the one using all of the negative language. So it's not all of them, but it's the ones with the bigger microphones. It's the ones with the bigger audiences. And so when you have a Bill O'Reilly who has a platform, and then you have a representative from the Congress to go on his show to kind of validate what he's saying and doesn't call him out on that, then what's the point? Why am I even going to consider talking to you? You've already made up your mind. You're not going to do anything different. And so until somebody begins to push the envelope and say, no, we can't continue like this. And how do you push the envelope? You get rid of people like Paul Ryan. That's what you do. Just because you've been somewhere in a seat for 20 years in that district doesn't mean you're going to be there for 20 more years. And so you find a way to find the right opponent to go against them, and you get rid of the Paul Ryans of the world. You know, and the Bill O'Reilly's, he'll have his platform. But I've said this from the very beginning. every time an elected official comes on television that's of the Republican Party and makes a crazy statement, there should be a Democratic congressperson on TV to counter that craziness. But it does not happen. Instead, they bring the crazy people on so they can double down on their statement, as opposed to having somebody challenge them on that statement. And then when you do get somebody to challenge them, then that person, and this is what Dr. Peterson said earlier today on MSNBC, is that they are good at blaming the victim and at acting like they're the victim. They've mastered that, because the one person that has challenged them, now all of a sudden they're picking on them. You know, it's like, you know, you can throw out all this hard stuff, but when somebody calls you to the carpet on what you said and what you really meant by it, then all of a sudden it's something against all Republicans. And nobody's ever said all of anything. But when that's the only voice I hear, the loudest, then I'm going to make the assumption that everybody else agrees, because anybody's saying nothing different. And so I want to be able to have a good a conversation about it that is devoid of the name-calling, that is even somewhat devoid of emotion. Because if all we're going to deal with is an emotion, we're never going to get anywhere. And so we have to call a truth on whether or not this was worse than this. It's all been bad. You know, it's all bad. But in such a time as this, when we have, you know, young men of color being incarcerated at higher rates than any other group, when we have young men of color who are being expelled from school at rates higher, and you have the same infraction by another student that is non-color, and they do not get expelled, you have to ask, what's the difference? You do the same thing, and yet one will get expelled and one gets in school detention. I mean, you know, why the disparities there? And so that's just, I mean, and you see it happening on so many levels that we cannot act as though race is not a factor. I'm not saying it's the only factor, but it is playing a part in the problem. And we cannot continue to keep our heads buried in the sand, saying, oh, it's not happening in my child's school, so I don't know what them other people are doing. Because you look up and it's going to be in your child's school. Guaranteed.
So it seems like Representative Barbara Lee, the Democrat from California, and our resident expert here, the Democrat from Texas, seem to agree. And I recall in Matthew chapter 18, verse 19, says that, again, truly I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything they ask for, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. So I ask you, what is the catalyst or impetus for the conversation to take place? Do we have to wait on someone from Washington, or can we start the conversation now? You know, when you look at the voice that most people have through social media these days, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and I don't want to leave any of them out, but I'm not going to be able to enumerate them all. But social media is a very influential platform for debate, for conversation, as we illustrated early on with Lemieux and Williams. So can we start the conversation now? Since two of you obviously agree, and from different sides of the world, when you're talking about geographically, then can we start this conversation ourselves?
I think we have started the conversation ourselves, and I think what I am most hopeful about is I hope we get to the point where we can have the conversation, we can start the conversation where it's not in response to something. So every time we have the conversation and it's in response to something that's happening, all the emotional stuff comes in. So why can't we just start a conversation about race when it's not in response to a Trayvon Martin or Jordan Davis or Paul Ryan's comments or Bill O'Reilly's comments or Jamila's comments or, you know, Glenn Beck? Why does it have to be in response to an issue that then we want to talk about something? when we already know all of the issues. I mean, you take a look at, I mean, let's just look at what's already happened. You take a look at voting rights and who, and this is not hyperbole. This is not make-believe. This is not, you know, something I just woke up and I said, come on, I'm going to make this statement. The data has proven. It is, as a scientist yourself, you believe in data. Data shows that the majority of people that have been and will be impacted, affected by the ruling of the Supreme Court as it relates to voting rights and what states are doing state by state as it relates to voting rights and voter ID and all of, and proof of citizenship, that the majority of the people that will be affected by this are people of color. There has been no amount of voter fraud in any other state that they are making these changes to justify making the changes. So one can surmise, in the year that a man of color is voted into the House that's white and has been white since it was there, built by black hands, but it's been white, since the occupant has changed to the color of the people that built the house, now all of a sudden we need to address people that are voting. How did he win all of those votes? They have to be cheating and lying about who they are. All of those people can't really be registered to vote. All of those people can't really be here legally. He had to have stolen the election. Now, we've had an election stolen, but it wasn't this one. If we go back to Bush and Gore, that was a stolen election with the same vote rules, mind you. Same ID laws that was in place then in 2000, same ones that was in place in all the other previous elections. And now all of a sudden we need to do something different. Now all of a sudden, well, if you got to have an ID to fly, you need to have an ID to go and vote. Okay. Make it so I can get one. Tell me how. So therein you have to say, there wasn't an issue before. We had a major election. This country did what it has implored other countries to do around the world, vote democratically. The vote happened. The President Obama was elected. And now all of a sudden, something's wrong with the voting system. And the majority of people who will be impacted and affected by the changes happen to be people of color, poor people, elderly people, and just throw this in, people that vote overwhelmingly Democratic.
Yeah, those are the facts.
Those are the facts. That you, as scientists, you the data man. So, you know, to me it's simple, but.
So let's do this. So we had this really great conversation about kind of the what and what we believe to be the why. So let's offer a contribution to the blueprint for the conversation to take place. Because if the conversation is beginning, if people are now starting to take one or two small steps forward towards having the conversation, because you hear Representative Barbara Lee talk about we need to have a conversation, you, in a whole different context, say that we need to have the conversation. And over the life of our program for the last 4 years, we've talked about having that conversation. So I want to offer a contribution to the conversation, or to the blueprint, I should say. And let's do that by framing how it should take place. And then every time we talk about this conversation, let's offer this suggestion to maybe a broader audience, and let's keep doing it so the conversation will take place. So in this blueprint, who would you say could be the moderator for a larger conversation? Who would be the right person to be able to say, okay, I have whites on one side, I have blacks on one side, or I have Republicans on one side or Democrats on one side, or I just have a room full of people of all different ethnics, and we begin to kind of have a conversation with a few questions? But who would be the person that we could say be the moderator?
Do you want a political person or a person that has the ability to manage the crowd and get out of the people that's in the room what you want to get out of them?
So you're not going to have
– that's a different skill set.
Right, because if you have a political person, then you're going to automatically have people go to their corners. Who could be neutral in such a way – that could be devoid of emotion, that could be devoid of politics, and that could really, you know, facilitate or moderate a good conversation that we could really get something out of? Because in my opinion, it's not just one conversation. It's a series of them covering a series of topics like economics, education, justice system, and a whole plethora of different topics. But who would be the moderator? Who could sit down and begin that conversation for us?
I don't know.
You know,
I mean, really.
So herein lies what I believe is some of the difficulty to having the real conversations. So somebody that is not going to go to their corner and be able to be real neutral in the – because we all bring our own biases, whether we want to own up to them or not. You know, I like the book The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Because it really talks about this concept of the Pygmalion effect, where people are, you know, they're a byproduct of their life experience, their cultures, and things that make them up. So the lens that you look through is not just the lens of your mind, but it's a lens of your upbringing, a lens of your culture, what you eat, what you see, what you listen to, what you read. And so when you bring all of that to the table, then it becomes very challenging to move all that aside. To really have that conversation. And in fact, since you are our residential psychologist, you know, we talk about this when you have those biases, when you're having a group session, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, you do. And I think, you know, there's, I don't know how well he would move the crowd, but I think he has enough respect on both sides of the aisle where he could probably start the conversation, and that would be Colin Powell. I think he has...
Okay, I like that.
Yeah, I think he has endeared himself and yet not endeared himself on both sides. I mean, he said some things that you're like, dang, that came from a Republican. And then he says some things where you'd be like, wow, that make a whole lot of sense. And so I think he has the right temperament. He has probably done, I mean, because you need somebody who's experienced it up close and personal. And he's been in the military. So we know he experienced some stuff in the military. We can play like he didn't, but we know he did.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And then his life has been one of service. And so he understands what that means, and he understands the what it means to be pragmatic on some things and then to be moving
towards a goal
others.
Or objective. You know, he knows that there's an end game in mind, and not to be distracted by all of this craziness. I think he has the right temperament for that too.
So,
of course, and that's why I always solicit your brilliancy. Because you always raise the game or raise the bar in this conversation, and so my next question then, if we got a moderator, Colin Powell, we get these people, these diverse people in the room, we begin the conversation about race. What would be the first question?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is define racism. We have to define it because we have to come from the same point and the same definition of it. Because if we're all coming from different definitions, we're never going to agree to the fact of what it is and what and how we can fix it. So we have to, first of all, define racism and come to an agreement of what we mean when we say someone is being racist or racist behavior or racist whatever. What do we mean by that? And then we have to define discrimination and discriminatory practices. And what is affirmative action really? And what was it originally supposed to do? And then we can start having the other conversations. But I think we have to first give ourselves a working definition of what is racism and what do we mean by that. And, you know, and I do respect Dr. Cornel West. He's lost me over these last couple of years. But in his book, Race Matters, I think is a good jump off because it makes you really think about, and there's so many others out there, but that one just popped up in my head. But you have to really define racism and what it is. We can't say what do you mean by race and what do you mean by racism. We can't get to a working definition for that for everybody in the room, then we're not going to get anywhere. So we have to define some things first.
Talking like a true scholar, I absolutely, definitely agree with you. So when you come to terms with what it means to be racist or to define racism or to define discrimination, affirmative action, to define how the legal justice systems affect everyone, then when you baseline the conversation, it's okay, now we all are starting from the same point. Where do we go? What becomes the objective out of the conversation? And again, this is in the context of our contribution to the blueprint for the conversation. We define who should be moderating it. We define what would be the first thing that we do by establishing the context. And now, how do we move? How do we take the first step?
Well, there has to be a list generated in terms of priorities, things that we know after we've defined race and racism and what it has had an impact on and how it has affected policies. Then we have to take a look at what those policies are, and we begin to categorize them. For all of his ill will these last couple of years, when Chavez was doing the State of Black America and he had the covenant with Black America and he had the 10-point plan, you know, there were certain things that we needed to do. And so I think we would have to begin to pull back the layers. What is the one common denominator? What is the one thing that has an impact on five other things? And that's where you start. So if it's education, which I believe has an impact on the economy, it has an impact on our criminal justice system, it has an impact on our health care. I think if you start with education and see how discriminatory practices become policy in certain realms of education, then you begin to address it there, then it will bleed over into criminal justice. It will bleed over into health care. It will bleed over into our economics. It will bleed. So I think we would have to say, you know, because you ask 10 people what's the top 10 things for you, you're going to get, you know, 100 different answers. But in there would probably be a couple of things that would be similar. And so come up with a list of what those similarities are and build from that. That's what you want to build from.
I like it. So I want to digress here for a moment so I can take another step forward in asking a different question. But when in psychology or sociology or in your group therapy sessions, is there a place for people to get things off their chest? Is there a place that says, okay, let it all out so you can begin to heal? Because if I have it bottled up inside me and, you know, I have all these, ill-conceived notions or misconceived notions of someone or something, my past or how I perceive the people around me or my family members, then it's hard for me to empty that out and then to begin to refill it with something positive or something that's going to be more effective. So is there room in psychology or sociology or in your field that allow people to do that?
Oh, for sure, because we can't get to the root of the problem if we're acting out of anger and frustration and hostility and disappointment and all those other emotions. And so you have to come in and empty yourself out, scripturally and spiritually, you have to come out and surrender it all and say, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be like this anymore. I'm tired of living like this. And who are you mad at? I mean, you got a lot of people that are angry, and they've never really admitted who the person they're really angry with. I mean, you think it's one person, and that's who they've said it is, but they only say that because that's convenient. But once you begin to pull back the layers and you find out what's really driving that behavior, what's really causing you to be angry and upset, then you can begin to heal. So, yes, we encourage it. You know, I used to tell, you know, my clients, and even when I was running my staff meetings and I could tell somebody had something else happening, I'm not going to get 100% out of you if you got all this blocking you from thinking. If you're not able to be clear to work with us, I'm not going to get out of you what I need. You're going to be more of a problem and a hindrance to the process. So let's just go on and dump it. And everybody has to, you know, put their shoulder pads on and bounce it and let it take what it's going to take. Take in what's yours. Release what's not yours.
I like it. So then if I come back to the conversation that we were having about the contribution that we're making to this blueprint, is there room for people to get these racist tendencies and notions off their chest? Is there room for people to explain who they're mad at, for them to peel back the layers in the same context in your group sessions or in your meeting with your clients? Is there room for people to do this in this blueprint?
Well, yes, but here's the thing, though. Here's the problem that I've noticed when people start talking about race and issues that they may have with it. Is there's a lot of invalidation, and I'm not even sure if that's the correct word or not, but people tend to invalidate when somebody says they've been mistreated because of their race. And they do that because it's uncomfortable to admit to. So if I tell you what I just experienced, and based on what I know about the person that did it, and based on my previous interactions with that person, I can pretty much say it had more to do with my race than, let's say, my gender or my age or, you know, my sexual orientation. I can pretty much tell you it was simply because of the color of my skin. I don't need you to try to make it be about my gender or my sexual orientation or anything. I need you to hear what I'm saying. And oftentimes, even when we're talking about things that happened with the president, you'll have somebody say, well, we don't know if it was if they said that because of his race. Well, they haven't said it about anybody else. And he's not doing anything that nobody else has done. So one has to take out all the other stuff and just call it what it is. So I think when we're having that discussion, we have to let people have their say. And we have to, as my mentor, Gail Mumford, used to say to me all the time, you have to suspend judgment. And although I may not think it's about race, let me let them talk it out. And they may eventually talk themselves out of thinking it had anything to do with race. Or they may, you know, it may be true and clear at the end of the dialogue, you know what, that really was that. And then I have to validate that for them, and then I have to help them work through that. But if I come in and I'm already saying it's not about race, this had nothing to do with race, just because the last part, I mean, if I invalidate their feelings off the bat, I'm not going to get anywhere. And so we have to learn how to validate where people are and meet them where they are, and then kind of help them figure it out along the way.
You know, I like that because, you know, without allowing people to really get that off their chest and to really not necessarily rant, but to at least give their opinion and then not have people invalidate that opinion, I think that sets the stage for people to have a real productive conversation or productive meeting because you allowed me to have my say. You didn't discredit me because of your experiences, because of your biases, and you allow me to really peel back the layers so that I can tell you, you know, how I'm feeling. And it's important how I'm feeling because it now allows me to empty myself so I can now be filled with all of the good information we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a grand contribution that we're making here to the blueprint, and we should use this as our foundation to begin to say we need to have this conversation. Here's how we think it should happen, you know, and we talked about some of the topics being economics, education, and justice systems, and we may need to unpack it to say maybe we start with education because it has tentacles that reach into these other issues like economics and the justice systems into joblessness and the unemployment rate and everything else. Because if we start there, or we may find out it's something else. But we start with the lowest common denominator, the least common denominator, least common multiple, then I think we can begin to build there. So finally, before we wrap this segment up, I need to end this segment here, is how do we know that the conversation has been successful?
Well, it's just like with any true dialogue, you see a change in the behavior. So if policies are not changed, if laws are not changed, if practices are not changed, then the dialogue didn't work. But if you begin to see even in one company where, you know, they're making changes to their hiring or they're making changes to their health care or they're making changes in this school where it's not a three strikes and you're out type of mentality, that they're really trying to address the needs of the students. If you begin to see changes, if you go from having a 60% dropout to a 30% dropout, you've done something different there. You know, that's whatever changes you made in your school system, you've made some changes to address whatever the real problem was. So that's how we'll know if the behaviors change. If the laws don't change, if police officers can still shoot and ask questions later, then the conversation hasn't changed. If we can look at the data that shows the disproportionate number of African Americans and people of color that are on the losing end of the stand your ground defense in all these different states, and we don't connect that to race and we don't change that, then the conversation was wasted. So we'll know that the conversation had an impact because it should have an impact on the policies that are being driven.
You know, that's an excellent point. You mentioned stand your ground. I want to kind of shift the conversation to an opening statement I made about Kobe and about Shaq in the news. This particular one is related to the stand your ground comment, stand your ground law, from a comment made by Kobe Bryant. And here's the comment that Bryant made. That's really drawing up some criticism. And he says, "I won't react to something just because I'm supposed to, because I'm an African American," he said. That argument doesn't make any sense to me. So we want to advance as a society and culture, but say if something happens to an African American, we immediately come to his defense. Yet, you won't talk about how far we progress as a society. Well, we progress as a society. They don't jump to somebody's defense just because they're African American. You sit and you listen to the facts just like you would in any other situation, right? So, I want to assert myself. Now, this is in response to, of course, to what he seemed to see that the Miami Heat did when they posed in support of Trayvon Martin by wearing the hoodies. That was a pretty famous picture that they did. And standing in solidarity to a cause or to something that you used to see athletes like Muhammad Ali and actors do all the time back in, you know, several decades ago. But some are more hesitant today. Now, I can applaud Jamie Foxx for really stepping up to the plate and really taking an active role in social issues that affect, because he know the people that make up his fan base are being affected. So I can again applaud him to Roger P. Henderson, all the people that are taking a stand in issues. And then yet I see Kobe Bryant here make these type of comments. He says that, well, we progressive society. They don't jump to somebody's defense just because they're African American. You sit and you listen to the facts, just like you would in any other situation, right? So I won't assert myself. So what's interesting about the conversation that he was having, or at least what he was, the rant he was on, was because of, you know, so many people came to his support in the defense after he was accused of raping this white woman in Colorado. As a matter of fact, everybody that was African American were vocal about his issue, and so it's odd to me, or it seems strange to me, that he would say this, and when so many people looked at the facts of the case and saw that there was clearly something wrong. Anytime you pursue a young man, you know, you get out of your car, your vehicle, you go armed with premeditation in your heart, because you're taking a weapon with you. And the guy was obviously going on doing his own business. And for him to say, you know, I'm not getting involved in the situation, and basically what I'm hearing, I find it troublesome. And so, Jim, I want you to kind of weigh in here. And so I have two questions. One, what did you think about Kobe's comments, I should say, because it wasn't really a response, but his comments about the Trayvon Martin case, and what do you think people are saying now, being that he took this position?
Well, I think he used a bad example. The short answer is that he used a bad example as it relates to Trayvon Martin and how the Miami Heat stood in solidarity with the family to at least get an arrest and have more investigation go into what actually happened. So I think he used a bad example, and I don't think it's about jumping on a bandwagon just because somebody is black, because I don't think anybody does that anymore. It doesn't just happen like that. And for him to have been the recipient of such a jumping on the bandwagon, I was in Colorado when that happened. So I mean, it was split right down, black and white. It was no green area there at all. It was black, it was white, and you had a few Hispanics that was kind of like, I don't even know what side to be on. But if you was black, you felt this way.
Right.
If you was white, you felt that.
Okay.
I mean, I lived it. You can even have a conversation.
Yep.
It was about, I mean, it reminded me of OJ and
yep,
his verdict and how that was right down the middle. I've never thought OJ did it anyway, because I've always had my theory about who did do it. So I never thought he did it, and even the evidence didn't convince me that he did. And so when that verdict came, the person that was my supervisor at the time was a white female, and how she went in all of our dorms and removed all of our TVs out so that we couldn't even watch any more of it, and how she banned us from even talking about it that night with the kids because she was angry, because she was white female, I'm a black female, and everybody's like, hey, you know, that's kind of infringement, you know. So it was split. So this particular case with Trayvon wasn't so much about, I mean, race was the undertone. It was, how does somebody have a right to take somebody's life and then say they were standing their ground when the other person was not the aggressor and the other person did not have a weapon? So why did you have a right to shoot somebody? That's what this case was about. And then all the other stuff came down, because as the investigation pursued, then you find out all these other issues about the perpetrator. So I think he just used a bad example there. And you know, it's unfortunate that he did, and it's unfortunate that he, you know, Stephen A. Smith went on Arsenio and basically agreed with what Kobe had to say. And I, you know, and that surprises me, because I generally agree with Stephen A. Smith as well. And so for him to say he understood where COVID was coming from, you just don't blindly support. Well, I don't think anybody was blindly supporting Trayvon Martin, or we couldn't even support him because the Pope baby was dead. I don't think anybody was blindly supporting his parents, but I did have a few questions, like how is this possible? What kind of law is this that you can just go off and shoot people and say, oh, I felt threatened, and get away with it? You know, what was happening? And so when you begin to investigate, which I don't think that the Miami Heat came out day one. I think it was after the rally, after the march, after certain things happened, that they decided, because they are in the state of Florida, that they needed to take a stand, and I applauded them for that then, as I do now. I just think Kobe used a bad example. That's about all. I mean, that's the only way I can give him a way out. He just used a bad example.
So talk a little bit about the conversation between at least Roland Martin and Kobe. What took place around the Twitter and things of that nature?
Well, what happened is Roland is who he is, and he began to go on one of his explanations, as I call it, his heated fellowship, where he was just talking about how he disagreed with what Kobe had to say. And he brought up historical facts, you know, in terms of, well, if these people hadn't, you know, rallied around, we would have never known this. And we would. And so he just had these different points in history where he was able to take us back to what happens when we continue to dig. See, the issue wasn't, when you're talking about George Zimmerman, they had decided there was nothing else to investigate. So the family was like, I cannot agree that there's nothing else to investigate. So the push was that we need to investigate this a little bit more. We need something else said about it. And so Roland just kind of called Kobe out on a few things and, you know, just kind of challenged his thought process. Well, in the midst of that, he stated that he was going to get on the flight, and he saw this number appear, and he didn't recognize the number, so he didn't answer the call. And then the person called right back, so he went ahead and answered it. Well, come to find out it was Kobe who, you know, wanted to have a conversation with him about what he was saying about him on Twitter. So I guess somebody must have got a hold of Kobe and was like, dude, Roland Martin is tearing you a new one on Twitter about what you said. So they had a conversation about it. And in that conversation, from Roland's perspective, you know, he was able to educate Kobe a little bit on the history of why we press. Because when we don't press, we get years of people being wrongfully incarcerated. I mean, just this week we've had three people that had been in jail over 30 years for crimes that they always said they didn't commit. And yet nobody, you know, because nobody was pressing it until lately, now all of a sudden, you know, people are coming out to say, no, they didn't do it. You know, whatever evidence is coming out. So you got a grandmother that's been in jail for 30 years for a crime she didn't commit. You got a father that's been in jail for 30-some years for a crime he didn't commit. Well, if we wait on the investigation, sometimes the investigation doesn't come unless we push. And that's what Roland's point was trying to be to Kobe.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about Shaq in the news, too. I had mentioned already that Kobe was in the news. Shaq is in the news for a different reason, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, kind of being a part of something that you're really not responsible for. So I want to play this about what's going on with Shaq, and if you haven't heard this, I want to get you to I want you to get you to respond. Take a listen.
We continue to follow a story we broke on Friday, the active police investigation into what did or did not happen at Turner Studios between former NBA player Shaquille O'Neal and an employee. Channel 2's Ryan Young was the first to report this story. Ryan joins us now live from Midtown Atlanta with what he's learned today. Ryan?
Look, investigators are remaining tight-lipped about this investigation. They will deliver their findings to the DA's office sometime in the near future.
On Inside the NBA, a show on Turner Broadcasting, the superstar talent is known for having a good time and lots of fun. Some of that play gets put on TV for everyone to see.
Oh, no, you guys started from the beginning. You guys
but now that play could lead to a big-time lawsuit. Friday, we confirmed the Atlanta Police Department is investigating an incident that happened last year between Shaquille O'Neal and Robert Williams, a production employee. Williams claims Shaq tackle-punched him.
And alleged that Shaquille O'Neal tackled him to the ground, causing injury to his back while they were at work at Turner Studios.
Monday afternoon, I tried talking to Robert Williams about his claims, but he didn't come to his door. But his attorney did send me this statement, which in part reads, "We understand that the physical attack between Shaquille O'Neal upon Mr. Robert Williams is under a criminal investigation. Mr. Williams is presently recovering after surgery. However, he does state emphatically the permanent injuries he received were not the result of participation in any form of horseplay." Shaq's lawyers also sent me a statement after our first story aired. "This was nothing more than horseplay," said Dennis Roach, attorney for Shaquille O'Neal. "No one intended for anyone to get injured. It will now be up to a criminal investigator to determine if anything criminal was done inside these studios last year."
So here we go. Robert Williams is accusing Shaquille O'Neal, Dr. O'Neal, I should call him, of tackling him to the ground and causing injury to his back. And I guess it wouldn't be so bad to me if they would have had a conversation about it, said, "Look, I hurt my back. You need to pay my doctor bills or whatever." But he's charging him criminally, which is, to me, is odd. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I don't even really know how this got to even be where it is right now, because it just seems so far-fetched anyway. And it could be an issue where one thought it was, he thought he could just, you know, put it out there and Shaq wouldn't want to deal with the pressure of it all and would just settle or whatever. But I really think this guy might have bitten off more than he can chew, and whoever was advising him really didn't do him any justice on this one. And so it's kind of hard to understand when people do things like this. And I don't even think it was, from what it sounds, it wasn't anything intentional. So what's his real beef? That's what I don't understand.
Exactly. Or was his real motivation?
Right.
Exactly. So speaking of biting off more than they can chew, I want to shift to the last segment of the day before we get your final thoughts. It's really about the regional director of the National Labor Relations Board ruled that Northwestern football players can unionize. So I guess my first question, Jimmy, what's the implication of having a college football team being able to form a union? You know, first, what's the impact? But more importantly, what's the impact on college sports? Because this really sets precedence for everything else.
Well, you know, as someone was stating the other day, I think it was a couple of people that was on the Melissa Harris Perry show over the weekend, and they had some really good insight into how the NCAA has been able for all of these years to get away with what they've been able to get away with. And that's because they have always, they came up with the term of student athlete. And because they came up with that term, then they have been able to circumvent exactly where we are right now. The problem is that we know that these student athletes are more than just students. We know that they bring a large amount of revenue to their college campuses. We know that the training department, the coaching staff, make millions of dollars off of these young men and women at their colleges, and that a lot of different things are generated that they do not have access to. I mean, their jerseys are sold, and they get no money from that. And so the argument is, well, they're getting an education. Yeah, they are, some of them, but there's no real push in the athletic department to ensure that the students, after the season is over, are eligible. I mean, they're real careful about it during football season and during basketball season to make sure that the players remain eligible so they can play. But when they're not in season, that same drive to keep them eligible and make sure they're going to their tutors and doing well on their tests and things is not there as much. So there is a disconnect there. And when you look at the amount of money that is generated by your major colleges, and not just, you know, the Alabamas and Texas and Oklahomas of the world, but when you even look at Northwestern as a private institution, you know, there is money that is generated there. And so why should not those athletes be compensated for that? And there is a lot of ways you can compensate. It doesn't have to be you pay them in money. You can pay them in kind. I mean, when it's against the rules for a coaching staff to buy one of his players a plane ticket to go home to bury his grandmother, the woman that raised him, and there's no other way he can get there, that is a travesty. And that's the NCAA. You know, a program can lose scholarships because a coach had compassion that knew that this child had no other means to get home. And, you know, the child could be from some rural place down here in Texas, and the school is way out in Seattle, Washington somewhere. Why is he going to get there, you know, or Chicago or New York or wherever he's from to go home to bury the woman that raised him? And so you have those types of stories, particular board, labor board, to say, you know, it may not go anywhere, of course, Northwestern's going to appeal, but it is causing us to have the conversation again. And maybe it's just like the race conversation. Maybe if we have the real conversation about, so when we say pay athletes, what do we really mean by that? Do we mean we give them money? Do we mean they have a stipend? Do we mean they have access to? I mean, what does that mean, that we will compensate them for what they are giving back to the university? And I think if we have that conversation about what we mean by compensation for athletes that happen to be students, then we can go ahead on and move somewhere. But, you know, once you hear compensation, the only thing you think about is money and paying, and that's not fair. Because for the school that may not be a Division I school in the top 25, you know, program or whatnot, how do they compensate? And if it becomes we only pay, that we're paying them, then the top-tier schools will always be top-tier because they're going to be able to pay the students more.
Yeah.
So yeah. What do you mean by that? So I think that's the conversation that has to be had as well.
What do you think the impact that the Grambling football team had on this conversation? The players reportedly were unhappy with being bused to games in Indianapolis and Kansas City. I think that's alluded to with the comments that you were making earlier. And they were unhappy about several things that were the conditions they were playing under. So do you think that this Grambling situation had any impact on, at least made any contribution to the conversation?
I do, and I think it was very admirable of them and courageous of them to take such a stand. And I think it caused other students at bigger colleges to be like, you know what, that's kind of messed up that they don't have what we have. Because when you have something, you don't realize that everybody don't have it. You know, when you play football at the university, you think everybody that plays football at the university travels like you do or has access to the same things you do. And it's not true. So when you thought that another brother, since they consider themselves to be a fraternity, is having to endure these type of conditions, you'd be like, well, wait a minute. Well, you know, that's true. We do have to. And why are we not? And so it creates a dialogue. So I think it could have been a catalyst to create a national dialogue, because it was, you know, that conversation came up again during that time period, and it talked about what the school was losing in terms of what the school was going to be fined, but what about what the athletes were losing, the students were losing for themselves. And so I think that may have been, you know, somewhat of a catalyst to continue the conversation. And I believe Northwestern's been working on this for a couple of years now. So it hasn't just been a reactionary to a thing. you know, they've looked at it, and whoever the lawyers are that's working with them on it, they got some pretty good data. So the NCAA is going to really have to take a look at how it's been circumventing this process for so long. And then we as society have got to say, well, why is that? And here's another thing. The data is showing split down the middle. When you ask people if athletes should be paid, you have an over majority of white people that say no and an over majority of black people that say yes. Well, why do you think that is? Who's out there doing all this on the football field and the basketball field, which are the sports that generate the most revenue on campuses? That's not to say that baseball is not important or hockey or gymnastics, but those aren't the sports that's generating the millions of dollars that's coming into that campus. And so when you look at it for just that, and you say, wow, we're even split down this thing on race. Here we sit. There it is again, staring you in the face.
Yep. So that's our show for the day. We're going to wrap up here. And I just wanted to just say again, what a wonderful job you're doing here. We applaud you here in all the things that you do. What are your final comments?
Today is March 30th. Tomorrow is March 31st. If you have not signed up for health care and you are in need of insurance, please, please, please go out and visit the healthcare.gov website and find a number and speak to a navigator that can help you process that and get through that to get yourself signed up before the 31st, which is tomorrow at midnight. So do not delay, do not tarry. We are handing off the baton to the last runner here, and we've got to get all the way around. And so if you know someone that needs to still make the call, and most of your major cities, either your local NAACP chapter, your National Urban League chapter, or even some of your larger churches, they are having workshops and people on site to help you navigate and get enrolled. So please reach out and find somewhere to go if you don't have access to the internet and you can't find a phone or whatever. Don't let that be the reason why you let this opportunity pass you by. Take charge of your own life. Take charge of your own health. Take charge of doing something for yourself, because you will be so happy when you don't have to be scared about getting sick or your children getting sick, that you'll be able to go to the doctor on a regular basis. It's a wonderful thing to be able to go to the doctor on a regular basis and find out all is well, or find out, you know, you could stand to lose about 40 pounds because if you come back in here again, I'm going to put you on some medicine because of. And so you can catch it before it gets to the because of. So that's my plea, that's my prayer, that those that are in need will go out to the website at healthcare.gov or call one of your local civic organizations, whether, as I stated, it's the NAACP, your National Urban League. I know here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the National Urban League is hosting all sorts of things. You can call some of your major hospitals. They are even having navigators on site setting up different workshops throughout to have people to be able to come in. Find some of your local community centers and recreation centers that may be offering it as well. So just please get covered. You know, that's the hashtag. That's my message, is to get covered.
All right. Since you mentioned happy, I think we'll leave with that.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
Well, that's our show for today. I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in, and a very special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. And you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima. That's AskJima. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to current events with Patrick Cook. Because I'm